The Dervish governor of Galabat was almost overcome by the honour of receiving the mighty Caliph Osman Atalan as a guest in his city. Immediately he vacated his own mud-brick palace and placed it at the disposal of the visitors. He moved into a much smaller, humbler building on the outskirts of the town. Osman decided to rest in Galabat until the cessation of the monsoon period, which would make travelling in the hilly country around Gondar almost impossible. This would entail a delay of several months, but there was much to keep him occupied. He wanted to gather every scrap of information that might be of importance during the coming campaign. He sent out word that the local guides who had taken caravans up to Gondar through the high passes and those warlike sheikhs who had raided the Ethiopian territories for cattle and slaves must come to him in Galabat. They hastened to his bidding. He questioned them at great length and recorded all they had to tell him. This information would comprise the bulk of his report to the Caliphate Abdullahi when he returned to Omdurman. Osman recalled that the Mahdi had used the white concubine Al-Yamal as a scribe and letter writer. She was skilled in many languages. He ordered her to be present at these interrogations, to write down the facts as they were revealed by the witnesses. He had seen little of Al-Yamal since the beginning of the expedition, for he had had marital obligations elsewhere, but Osman had barely settled into the governor's palace before the older women slaves of the harem came to him with the news that his youngest wife had at last responded to his repeated attentions by missing her moon. They informed him that she had not flown her red banner for 2 months past. Osman was pleased. His fourth wife was a niece of the Caliphate Abdullahi, and therefore her pregnancy was of great political importance. Her name was Zamata. Although she had a pretty face, she enjoyed her food and had thick thighs, a pudding-shaped belly, and a pair of soft, cow-like udders. At this time in his life, Osman Atalan demanded more from his favourites than a musical giggle and a willingness to lie back and open their legs. He had done what had to be done, and now he felt no inclination to spend more time in the company of the dull-witted Zamata. During the first few days of the interrogations, Al-Yamal had taken up an unobtrusive position behind the governor's dais in the audience hall. On the third day, Osman ordered her to move to a seat below the front of the dais. Here she sat cross-legged with her writing tablet on her lap, directly in his line of vision. He liked the quick movements of her slim, pale hands, and the texture of the cheek that was turned towards him as she wrote. As was fitting, she never raised her eyes from the parchment or looked at him directly. Once or twice, while he was watching her, a mysterious smile touched her lips, and this intrigued him. Seldom before in his life had he been concerned with what his women were thinking, but this one seemed different. "Read back to me what you have written," he ordered. She lifted those strangely pale blue eyes to look at him, and his breath caught. She recited the evidence without having read it. When she finished, she leant towards him and dropped her voice so that he alone could hear. "Trust him not, great lord," she said. "He will give you little for your comfort." They were the first words she had ever addressed to him. Osman's expression remained impassive, but he was thinking quickly. He had let it be known that he was conducting these inquiries to facilitate trade with the Abyssinians and plan his state visit to Gondar. Had this woman guessed his true intentions, or had she been informed? What grounds did she have for the warning she had just given him? He went on with his inquiries, but now he studied the man before him more intently. He was an elderly caravan master, prosperous from the cloth of his robes, intelligent, judging by the depth of his knowledge. In all other respects, he was unremarkable. He had stated that he was of the tribe of Hadendawa, yet he did not affect the patch jiba, and there was something alien in his accent and the manner of his speech. Osman considered challenging his identity, but discarded the idea. He looked for the other signs that Al-Yamal must have noticed. The man leant forward to take the small brass cup of coffee from the tray that had been placed before him, and the neck opening of his robe gaped to show a flash of silver. It was a fleeting glimpse, but Osman recognized the ornately engraved Coptic Christian cross that hung on a chain round his neck. "He is Abyssinian," Osman realized. "Why would he dissemble? Are they spying on us as we are on them?" He smiled at the man. What you have told me has been of great value. For this I thank you. When do you begin your next journey? Great Caliph, 3 days hence, I leave with 200 camels laden with rock salt from the pans at Al Glosh. And what is your destination? I travel to the new city of Addis Ababa in the hills, where I purpose to barter my salt for ingots of copper. Go with God, good merchant. Stay with God, mighty Atalan, and may angels guard your sleep. When the caravan owner left the audience hall, Osman gestured Al-Nur to his side. When the Agajir knelt beside him, he whispered, "The merchant is a spy. Kill him. Do it secretly and with cunning. None must learn who delivered the blow." "As you order, so shall it be done." The staff left the hall, each making an obeisance to the caliph as he passed. But when Al-Yamal rose to follow them, Osman said curtly, "Sit by me. We shall talk a while." By this time, Rebecca could act the part of a concubine. The Mahdi had taught her how to please an Arab master. Flattery was the one sure way to achieve it. She was always astonished at how they would accept the most extravagant hyperbole as nothing more than their due. While she spouted this nonsense, she could efface herself and keep her true feelings hidden. She sat as he had ordered, and with her face veiled, waited for him to speak. "Remove your veil," he said. "I wish to see your face while we discourse." She obeyed. He studied her features in silence for a while, then asked, "Why do you smile?" "Because, my lord, I am happy to be in your presence. It gives me great pleasure to serve you." "Are all the women in your country like you?" "We speak the same language, but none of us is like the others. Great Caliph, I am sure your women are no different." "Our women are all the same. The reason for their existence is to please their husbands." "Then they are fortunate, great Atalan, especially those who have the honour to belong to you. How did you learn to read and write?" "My lord, I was taught to do so from an early age." "Your father did not forbid this?" "Nay, sweet master, he encouraged it." Osman shook his head with disapproval. "What of his wives? Did he allow them to indulge in such dangerous practices?" "My father had one wife, and she was my mother. When she died, he never remarried." "How many concubines?" "None, exalted Caliph." "Then he must have been very poor and of little standing in this world." "My father was the representative of our queen, and well beloved by her. I have a letter from Her Majesty that says so." If the queen truly loved him, she should have sent him a dozen wives to replace the old one. Osman was fascinated by her replies, each of which led him immediately to another question. He found it difficult to imagine a land where it rained almost every day and was so cold that the raindrops turned to white salt before they hit the ground. "What do the people drink? Why do they not die of thirst if the water turns to salt? My master, before very long the snow turns back into water." Osman looked up to the spade-shaped windows. "The sun has set. You must follow me to my quarters. I wish to hear more of these wonders." Rebecca's spirits quailed. Since she had been taken into the Zenana, she had been able to avoid this confrontation. She smiled prettily and covered her mouth with one hand, as she had seen the other women do when overcome with shyness. "Again you fill my heart with joy, noble lord. To be with you is all in this life that gives me pleasure." The cooks brought up the evening meal to his quarters, while Osman prayed alone on the terrace, which commanded a grand vista of distant mountains. As soon as he had completed the complicated ritual, he dismissed the cooks and ordered Rebecca to serve his food, but showed little interest in it. He took a few mouthfuls, then made her sit at his feet and eat from his leavings. He continued to ply her with questions and listened intently to her replies, hardly allowing her a chance to swallow before he asked the next question. Sometime in the early hours of the morning, she slumped over and fell into a deep sleep on the cushions from sheer exhaustion. When she awoke, it was dawn, and she was stretched out, still fully dressed, on his angareb. She wondered how she had got there. then remembered her dream of being a small girl again, and her father carrying her up the stairs to bed. Had the caliph carried her to bed? She wondered. If he had, that was some small miracle of condescension. She heard excited shouts and galloping hooves from below the terrace and rose from the bed, went to the window and looked down. In the courtyard, Osman Atalan and some of his agajirs were trying out a string of unbroken three-year-old horses that had been the gift of the governor of Galabat. Penrod Ballantyne, almost indistinguishable from the Arabs, was up on a frisky bay colt that was bucking furiously around the yard with arched back and stiff legs. Osman and his other agajirs shouted with laughter and offered ribald advice. These days, whenever Rebecca laid eyes on Penrod, her emotions were thrown into uproar. He was a heartbreaking reminder of that long-ago existence from which she had been snatched so untimely. Did she still love him, as she had once thought she did? She was not sure. Nothing was certain any longer, except that the man who stood at the opposite end of the yard now ruled her destiny. She stared at Osman Atalan, and the despair she thought she had subdued returned in full force to overwhelm her like a dark wave. She turned from the window and stared at the Webley revolver that lay on a side table across the room. She had seen the caliph place it there before he went to his prayers the previous night. It had probably been taken from a dead British officer at Abu Klea, or perhaps even looted at the sack of Khartoum. She crossed the room and picked it up. She opened the action and saw that every chamber was fully loaded. She snapped it shut and turned to the mirror on the facing wall. She stared at her image as she cocked and lifted the pistol to point at her own temple. She stood like that, trying to summon that last grain of determination to press the trigger. Then she noticed in the mirror the initials engraved discreetly in the butt plate of the weapon. She lowered it and examined the inscription. D.W.B. From S.I.B. with love, she read. David Wellington Benbrook. From Sarah Isabel Benbrook. This had been her mother's gift to her father. She hurled it from her and ran from the room back to the Zenana to find Nazira, the only person in the world to whom she could turn.